On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to a magical Conversation Hour today. Oh, love a bit of magic. Tim Ellis is a magician. Melbourne Magic Festival is coming your way. Sir Richard Taylor is more than a magician. He's the guy that's created the bugs, the huge, bigger than life size, bigger than our life size bugs that are part of the Melbourne Museum exhibition on Bug Lab, Little Bugs and Superpowers. So they're sort of like great big King Kong sized bees and ants and things like that. He's a bit of a magician. And Dr. Ranjana Srivastava is a magician in oncology. She's author, broadcaster, columnist for The Guardian, and occasionally even gets to see patients and treat them for cancer, and is my co-host today. Ranjana, good morning to you.
Good morning, John. No, I mostly see patients and occasionally come in and co-host.
How do you get the time? I mean, this is like a little indulgence for you, is it?
The radio bit is. The medicine isn't.
No.
Medicine is my bread and butter.
Yeah, I can well imagine. Got a couple. I've had a number of people get bad news in your line of work this week, and it's just so, it's such a profound reminder of how fragile is the thread on which we hang. It's, it's astonishing. Maybe it's a function of my stage of life, my age at nearly 61, where I'm sort of going, it's people left, right, and just about every second day you hear of someone else who's sick.
Oh, not at all, John. I think it's not only a profound reminder to patients, but a profound reminder to doctors and all the people who look after these patients. You know, giving this kind of news, I think, is absolutely life-altering for me. I'm the person who often tells people about their diagnosis, and I tell you, it's every single time it never fails to move me, to make me think about the bigger picture in life. It gives me perspective. Yeah.
It would never get easier, but I guess at some point if people know, if they're even coming to see you, they know there might be a problem.
Well, this is a good question. You know, should it get easier? And I actually think, no, it shouldn't get easier for an oncologist to say to someone that you have a life-changing diagnosis of cancer. And the thing about cancer is, no matter whether you can parse your words, and increasingly there are early diagnosed cancers and you go on to have a good prognosis and a good life, but I think the mere brush with that word changes your life forever. This is what I see all the time. And so should it get easier for an oncologist after 10 or 15 years, as I have been, to say, well, you've got cancer, but you'll be okay? I don't think it should. I think we need to respect every patient, because it's the only time for the patient. And to me, I devote a lot of time thinking about how to give the news, what to say to patients, how to support them. And I hope that I never become complacent about that.
Is this the sort of thing you go to conferences to talk about?
Well, we go to conferences, but there's not a lot of talk about this sort of thing.
No, you talk about the latest research and the new drugs that the multinational companies are offering to provide you if only you will accept their hospitality for 3 days in some tropical resort first.
There's less and less of that, but let me tell you about the most recent conference that I went to in Chicago, which is the world's largest oncology conference, and that week in June is a bad time to get sick because all the oncologists are in Chicago, literally almost. So, you know, there are 50,000 people who go to this conference.
And how many?
50,000. 50. Everyone is there. It really is a bad time to get sick.
50,000?
It is enormous.
Can you possibly get across what's going on?
Well, this is, and there are multiple concurrent sessions. And it's in Chicago. And the funny thing is, as soon as you get down from the plane, there are all these ads because there's direct-to-consumer advertising, right? So you begin to see pictures nestled among trees. Are these billboards about what drug you should be prescribing your patient and so on.
Sorry, 50,000
really
oncologists.
It's enormous. It is like nothing else
It's the whole world.
The whole world of oncologists, and including people from the developing world and, you know, poor countries, rich countries, all the oncologists try to get to this meeting. So let me tell you about, I think, the most important study that was presented there from my point of view, which is directly beneficial to patients. Because, you know, part of being in a crowd of 50,000 people is you have more than 5,000 papers presented. So how do you pick something out of there and say, this is actually really important for my patients.
How could anybody be across so much information simultaneously?
Well, you pick and choose. So you pick and choose what you go to, depending on what you sort of subspecialize in or what you feel there is a lot of excitement in or what you need to learn about. It's an impeccably organized conference, by the way. It really is a sight to see. But let me tell you about the study that I think is so directly applicable to patient care. So, you know, when you have cancer and you are having chemotherapy, you go along to the doctor every 3 weeks or 4 weeks and the doctor says, what symptoms did you have? And then you report whether you had nausea, vomiting, hot flushes, you know, pain, fatigue,
hair loss,
the rest
headaches.
Of it. So like most powerful studies, this was a really elegant study that said, we need real-time reporting of these symptoms rather than when patients come back to the oncologist, by which time they may have forgotten some of their symptoms, they may make light of some of them and only report the most extreme ones. So they took a bunch of, you know, real-world patients with all sorts of cancers, and they gave them access to an iPad or to a tablet and said, when you are home and you're experiencing these symptoms, grade them on a scale of 1 to 5 and just press a button and send. Or if you happen to be coming to the hospital for any other reason during the period that you are recovering from chemotherapy, go to one of the kiosks and fill out some information about your symptoms. And it's called patient-reported outcomes. So the results were that patients actually filled out the forms and reported their symptoms firstly, which is always important because you give patients something, you want to know whether they actually complied with it. It reduced hospital emergency department presentations. It made doctors Because the information was sent to the health professional to say your patient is experiencing these symptoms while they are at home.
So you could then nip something in the bud before it became an emergency. Okay,
exactly.
Right. Okay, I see the
link. So reduced hospitalization, reduced emergency department presentations, got doctors and nurses to better manage these symptoms. But perhaps most importantly in the world of oncology, and this came as a surprise to many people, it extended survival by 5 months. And the single...
Just by communicating
those complications that patients were having in real time. And the 5 months, which is a lot in the world of oncology. And the most memorable slide from this presentation was they put up a list of 12 drugs that have been approved in the last year by the Food and Drug Administration, cancer drugs. Each of those drugs, bar one, had a survival gain of 2 months and cost hundreds and thousands of dollars. And here is this tablet, this humble tablet.
So instead of the pharmaceutical approach, which delivered 2 months extra life, communicating better increased survival by 5 months.
By 5 months.
Without spending huge sums of money.
Because it was cheap, it was effective, it was so elegant. And, you know, one of the concerns that you often hear brought up is, well, there are a lot of older people who have cancer and they may not get on the internet, they may not know how to use a tablet, and that was proven to be a myth. People, you know, 3/4 of people filled out those because they were easy things to do and they were in your interest. And of course, what it allowed health professionals to do is act on those things in real time instead of waiting for your next appointment.
Which can be ages away, yep.
To say, you know, well, what do we do about this?
Okay, but then on the other end of the scheme, okay, so I'm one patient. I've got a smartwatch or a tablet or a smartphone with an app on it, and I can go, oh, Ranjana, I just felt ill. I just vomited or whatever. What can I do about it? That means I'm expecting someone's on the other end of it 24/7. That's not possible.
So someone collates those emails, and depending on the severity that you are reporting, so you might say, I'm feeling a bit ill, or you know, you are grading this, but it alerts someone. It alerts somebody, and there's
a trigger. But who's monitoring it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Who can be doing that?
Nurses. Doctors are alerted to it, but it's no different to the phone
calls.
So it's
not going straight to you. It's going to a clinic somewhere or someone that's monitoring all of these.
It's going to a health professional who is allocated It's their job to monitor this incoming stuff.
So 20 oncologists could pull together having someone who, a service that responds like nurse on call kind of thing. Is that how it works?
Well, yes. And the nurse could speak to the doctor. The nurse could call you and reassure you.
When it's necessary, yeah.
Exactly.
A lot of the time
the reason that it's thought to have improved survival is because you were able to tackle complications earlier, which actually meant that people could stay on treatment longer.
So you pick up infections before they got bad, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, you dose modify earlier, you bring them in earlier. So really interesting and so applicable to patients. So while we wait for this technology to be used more, more commonly in our hospitals, I think the thing I'm saying to my patients is, take note of this and make note of your symptoms and call your nurse or call the office of the oncologist and report them because it makes a difference.
All the professions, and it's not just yours, but accountants, lawyers, dentists, all professions, mechanics, plumbers, the opportunities in new technology are extraordinary. So if I'm waiting in the doctor's surgery to, I don't know, get my blood pressure taken or have my heart checked, to see whether or not the cramp I just had is or isn't something I need to be concerned about, or whether the symptom I've got is, you know, going to flare up my ears sore or whatever. I kind of think it'd be good. There's a whole lot of brochures on the wall. That is so 1980s. There's a television in the corner, which is showing rubbish commercial free-to-air television. I kind of think this is really weird, you know. There's so much good medical information. Why doesn't the clinic have, when I go and see the nurse and I make the appointment, when I arrive, why don't they give me an iPad or a tablet that's got something on it relevant to what I'm coming to see them about so I can learn a bit more about it before I go in? It saves the doctor time, saves me anxiety, and means I go in there having at least got a head start on what it is that I'm seeking advice about. And the professions, same with the dentist, same with the mechanic about, you know, if you know more about what's wrong with your car, well, you won't be resentful when it costs money to fix, or you won't ask them to fix the wrong thing or whatever it might be. It's just using communication tools, using new technology to improve things.
Yeah, I think you can certainly address general health literacy. So I was at a doctor's recently and, you know, there were reminders on the video screen about flu shots, about why it's important to get a flu shot. And I thought exactly that. It was a good use of a screen. People could watch it. You know, there were brochures around as well. In terms of, you know, how can we better educate people about their diagnosis? So I suppose if you're waiting at the doctor's, the reception may not know what your diagnosis is or what health education you need. But I think there is a lot of room for just general health literacy about diet, about exercise, vaccinations and the rest of it. And I do think that the more modern medical practices are beginning to realize how to harness that technology.
Well, I expect that there's probably going to be a bit of an explosion in it because apart from anything else, it makes the provider's life easier. So they make more turnover, more money economically. It just makes sense. Hey, we better get a wriggle on. We've got two magicians joining us. One's a real magician. The other one, he's more than a magician. He's a creator of extraordinary things that you're going to see at the Melbourne Museum at the Bugs exhibition coming your way. So Richard Taylor is over here from the better part of the southeastern corner of the globe, from New Zealand. He's here because he's created much of what is in the Melbourne Museum's Bug Lab exhibition, which opens right now. Bug Lab Little Bugs Superpowers is on until the middle of October. And Sir Richard Taylor is creative director and co-founder of what's called the Weta Workshop. Morning to you, Sir Richard.
Good morning to you.
When did the knighthood come your way?
A few years ago now. Very big surprise. You know, we're knowing where I've come from as a person and where I grew up, and then having that letter come through the mail was certainly first thing my daughter wanted to know was when do we move into the castle. But sadly not.
And what was the citation for your
contributions to the film industry of New Zealand and efforts to help young people with their careers, etc. So.
Well, congratulations. Can we just call you Richard?
Yeah, please. Thank I've you. Never got used to this air thing.
I hope it gets you upgrades on planes and things.
Well, are you? I my only card with Sir printed on it is when I'm traveling, doing business in China, because in China, it's a good key that unlocks certain doors.
And I would have thought back in the old country too.
I've not had to experience that.
Oh yeah. Well,
that reminds me. I was speaking to a Nobel Prize winner who was telling me how difficult it is to get into the United States these days, and how much the hassles at customs. And I said, well, don't you just take out your Nobel Prize medal and show that off? And he said, oh, rubbish, they wouldn't know what it was.
For the last 2.5 years, someone with my first, middle and last name and my same birthday is an escaped convict in America. So even if I'm traveling with my family, even though my title's on my passport, still go into the little room.
Sorry, your same birthday as
you,
well.
You figure out the potential of that set of circumstances. And this, I know everything about this individual now. He's got a tattooed chest, scars on his wrist, tattoo on his face, etc. But none of that will get me out of going into the little room.
Just in case. Yeah. Anyway, Richard, tell us how you became, are you an animatronic? Genius, is that the best description to give to it?
I have a love of making things, and that's what got me into the trade. I grew up in small town rural New Zealand, just loving making stuff with my hands, making stuff in the garden shed that my dad used to work out of. And when I moved to Wellington with my wife, it was a natural course of events that we'd end up in the creative industries, primarily the film industry in Wellington. But we definitely don't think about ourselves as a film company. We think about ourselves as a creative services company, because we work across such a broad spectrum of things.
And do you have a love of bees, or the bugs and bees, or is this just another job when you're asked to put together the constituent parts of a big exhibition?
Yes, it's never another job to me. We wouldn't take on the job if we didn't have a fascination for it. So I call it being a momentary expert. If you work on Master and Commander for 1 year, you have to become an expert in square rigger ships. And if you're working on bugs, then obviously the entomologists at Te Papa, our National Museum, bring the true expertise. But you do have to learn about them. And I find that one of the richest parts of the project is actually getting to discover the stuff.
Richard, I find it astounding the level of success you have achieved, but maintaining your base in a small part of New Zealand, really, which really is very distant from the rest of the world. And I wonder whether that's an advantage in some ways and preserves the mystique of what you do, or a disadvantage in this commercial world.
It's a huge advantage in that a great deal of what we do is driven by creative design, and that requires originality. No one wants to watch tomorrow what they saw yesterday. And it means that the people that are working with me have the Pacific culture to draw on, our own indigenous culture, the fauna and flora of our own unique world. So we don't end up in that internet soup that you see often with concept design, etc. And people have been able to retain their own proud sort of heritage of design, and that's a huge advantage. What isn't an advantage is being nearly invisible to the industry, and we travel frequently to go and make sure that we stay in the front of their purview, and they think of us when there's the potential of work.
But it makes you more resilient. I think Australians are similar. What was that film, The World's Fastest Indian, about the guy Bert Munro, who was a tinkerer who then just kept experimenting because of the isolation. He was self-reliant and came up with engineering solutions to problems no one else had thought of.
Yeah, I've said in the past, if you've got fantasies in your head and you can't buy them blister-packed from the corner store, you're going to have to invent them with your hands. And I think Australia and New Zealand, probably more so than almost any other nation in the world, is a nation of innovators, because you couldn't just buy the repair kit for the tractor. You couldn't go and get the components you needed easily. So there's always been this number eight fencing wire mentality. And that is definitely the core of our workshop, this love of making, love of inventing. The most critical thing for us is what I call innovative methodology. We can't beat our nearest competitors by lowering our staff's pay. We can't do a lesser job, otherwise we would lose our edge. So you have to innovate methodologies. You've got to come up with new and brighter ways to do things.
Do you have a shed at home as well?
I don't actually. I have, because our shed, which is the workshop, is 10 minutes drive, so I just stay there and love making things, you know, as my hobby as well as my career.
So you, when you don't have to do jobs for clients, what do you do for yourself?
I love to sculpt. That's my first calling. I'm passionate about sculpting. And I make what are called garage kits, which are sort of 12-inch tall model kits. But my great love is miniature...
Kits of garages.
Kits of characters. They're called garage kits because the people that make them invariably make them out of their garages at home and then trade them on this underground market to nerds like me. So they're of pop culture characters. But my great love is miniature steam engines. And I've built a...
stationary or rolling?
No, rolling. So
steam rollers or train engines?
Train engines, yeah, locomotives. 7.25-inch track width, exactly what you drive here in Australia. In fact, you've got an extraordinary track not far from Melbourne. I think in Buller, is there a place near here? Anyway, very beautiful track. So I drive the same track gauge and love working at that scale.
Richard, I was fascinated to read that you started sculpting with margarine or butter and moved on to clay and so on. That's fascinating.
When I first got into doing this, there was no publications that told you about what to do, we hadn't met anyone that was doing what my wife and I were building. So I was actually doing buffet sculptures at a local restaurant, which I was swapping for a square meal for my wife and I, and that's where I discovered margarine. And so about the first 300 or 400 commercial sculptures I did in the film industry were sculpted in margarine.
So with these bugs, I mean, they look amazing. You see, he's a child genius. My children do not sculpt their butter. They just eat it.
Yeah.
These bugs look amazing. I mean, you know, they're pretty indescribable, life-size sort of structures. And I was wondering, as I was looking through some pictures, and I have every intention of going and seeing the exhibit, which just started, did they turn out how you imagined them? And perhaps, how do you even imagine what this will look like?
Well, the challenge with the subject of bugs is, to the average person, they're not fascinating. In fact, they may even think they're boring. They're these things, they're annoying things that are in our lives. But of course, they're totally connected to our existence on the planet. Without them, of course, we wouldn't exist. So how do you create an exhibition that brings utter fascination and joy to the subject of bugs? We invented the term bug nouveau. So the exhibition is not built by us. It's actually built and designed by bugs. So the language of the exhibition is a visual language that we've never seen before, because it's unique to the bug world as the conceit of design. And then the opportunity to build those bugs, we actually use photogrammetry, where we brought bugs in from around the world. Photogrammetry. So I'll explain. It's pretty cool. We then dissected the bugs into their smaller components. We then had to shave the bugs, because you can't actually photogrammetry something with hair on it. And then you take about 250 photographs of each component and a computer program, which is very inexpensive. You can download a free version on the internet. We'll actually assemble it into a three-dimensional object.
So you're using CAD, computer-assisted design?
We use extensive digital processing for the physical models we make. So the bugs that you see in the exhibition are almost entirely 3D printed.
So in effect, you're dissecting them, mm-hmm. reducing them to their constituent parts,
correct?
Magnifying them, CADing them, playing around with them and then 3D printing the results and assembling them again.
Correct. That's exactly the process.
Fantastic.
And then we paint them and put hair into them.
Now, what sort of 3D printer are you, what are you printing? What medium are you printing them in on 3D printer?
In the case of those bugs, we were printing in a variety of different mediums. We're both resins and thread-based printing technology, but all to a very, very high level. They still require a level of finishing in as much as we have to put the hair into the surfaces of them. When you see the, if you get to see the bees are completely covered in hog hair, pig hair.
So using hog hair to replicate the tiny fibres on
the bee. Correct, because we have to get the dent, the measurement of a hair is called denier, and you've got to get the denier of the hair correct to that was on the bee when
so
it was
scaled.
Or everything scaled exactly to
just
the...
Just like your steam engines.
Correct. It's all about scaling in our career. If you think about the hobbits, they're all just scaled. You know, it's imperative that it works. Otherwise, the audience, who are very sophisticated viewers, can see the mistake.
Richard, I have to ask before we let you go. You have won 5 Oscars. What is it like being at an Oscar ceremony?
Well, it's actually very alien to our lives back home. You never set out to win an Oscar. You set out, I guess, to do really nice work that people may enjoy. So the discovery of going to the Oscars, the staff that work with us were embarrassed for me at some level that I had to go and be in the public eye on the world stage and not win the Oscar. But when we won them, of course, it was a nice exclamation mark to the efforts everyone had made. And being there and being acknowledged by your peers to the degree that is a nice thing. But you never win an Oscar, I guess. You collect it for a group of people. And the nicest thing from the Oscar experience is actually bringing it home. And
hand luggage.
Yeah.
Does that get you through customs, or do you still go into the little
room?
Well,
we have the same show you do, which is Border Control, and they stop me and ask to see inside my luggage. And they... And at one point, I brought one of them home in a Marks and Spencer's bag, and it split and fell on the ground and rolled away on the tarmac. Anyway, but it's been quite a unique experience.
Okay, now just because it's my inner geek coming out, before we bring our next guest in, who's a regular magician as opposed to a high tech magician. What's the biggest steam engine you've made for your 7.5-inch scale robot?
The largest steam engine that I've got is a third scale replica, a fantasy-based replica of an American steam locomotive. It can pull about 80 people on the flat, so it's pretty serious.
How many driven wheels?
It's got 6 driver wheels. It's all locomotives have very little grip on the track, of course, but they have immense power.
Torque.
So all powered by coal or coke in this matter. So, yeah, great fun.
It sounds like it. You have a lot of fun, far too much fun. It's not fair. Sir Richard Taylor, co-founder and creative director of Wellington's Weta Workshop, who's created the objects that you'll see at the Melbourne Museum, Bug Lab, Little Bug's Superpowers. If you want to have the mysteries of nature explained to you because of these scaled-up little critters, it all starts to make sense. So Richard, Ranjana Srivastava and I will be joined by magician, founder of the Melbourne Magic Festival, Tim Ellis. The 10th annual Melbourne Magic Festival is opening up, and he'll be our next guest on today's Conversation Hour, a magical Conversation Hour here on ABC Radio Melbourne. Miniature railways in Melbourne, Bulla, that's Bulla,
yeah.
Lower Plenty, Eltham, Box Hill. The Box Hill one's the closest one, just at Elgar Road.
Oh, 6 years ago, I drove out to the Bulla one on the invite of an amazing enthusiast that lives here in Melbourne and enjoyed my time out there.
Yep, it's a wonderful, wonderful hobby. We're all joined in the studio now by magician and founder and artistic director of the Melbourne Magic Festival, Tim Ellis. Ladies and gentlemen, pull a rabbit from a hat and put your hands together. Morning to you, Tim.
Thank you.
I thought you'd come in and saw somebody, maybe Richard in half or something like that.
As we were saying before, magic on the radio is challenging.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, Ranjana will do the sort of, you know, the unveiling of whatever, if you like. No, magicians, how did you get into the game?
I started when I was 10 years old when my grandfather gave me a magic set. and I learned all the tricks from that magic set. And
from Barnard's the show?
No. It was actually from Meyer, where he worked. And then after I learned all those tricks, I went to the library, bought lots of books from the library, and then went to Barnard's at that point. And I learned some tricks from Barnard's.
It used to be in Elizabeth Street.
Well, I owned it for a while.
You did?
I actually liked the magic so much, I bought the shop, you know. So I ran it for a little while, and now it's gone. And it was one of the world's oldest magic shops. It was started in 1937.
I thought Melbourne lost something inestimable when that disappeared.
Well, unfortunately, times change, don't they?
It's like the Dolls Hospital in the Block.
Oh, yes, okay. Yes.
You know, one of those little relics. And you say, well, as long as the Dolls Hospital is still okay.
All's right with the world.
All's still all right, yeah.
Magic has such enduring popularity. Why did the shop close down?
I can't comment. I have no idea why the shop closed down. I owned it for a while, and it was doing quite well, but I don't know what's happened, so... Yeah,
I presume the shop front was worth more for some other purpose. Let's not.
I think the rent went up basically.
Yes,
I think,
let's probably not get stuck in that. So, when did you decide though that instead of it just being something geeky that a schoolboy would do, that it was actually a calling?
I never ever thought it was just something geeky the schoolboy would do. It was always my calling. I've never had another job. Since the age of 10, that's all I've ever done. I like to describe it as saying I have actually no practical, tangible talents other than magic, so I have no choice.
Tim, when you fill in the passport form or when you fill in the departure card, do you seriously put down magician?
No, I never put down magician. I put director because I'm a director of a company.
You so learned that the hard way, I suspect.
When we were going through after 9/11, we were touring America, and every time they'd stop and they'd see the stuff in there and say, what is this stuff for? And so magicians, I would have to do a trick for them, otherwise it wouldn't let us through.
I used to write down model maker as my craft, and I quickly learned that that was unwise because in the US they think that to be a model maker is to find beautiful young women and make them the models on the catwalk. And you'd end up trying to, you know, answer questions about, well, what's the star that you've made in the world? So I now do the same as you do.
What do you put down? What you put down?
CEO.
What?
So it's never caused any concern.
No, I think putting down magician on the census or whatever else would be a wonderful thing.
Oh, the census is okay. Yeah.
You get away with that there. Yeah. So has anything new happened in the world of magic, given how much technological change there is in every other walk of life? Is there new?
There's always stuff happening in the world of magic. And the hardest thing is, like a lot of people now, because some magicians, they're usually quite ahead of technology. And so they might use a technical innovation to create an effect. But now it only lasts 6 months or a year before that innovation is now on the shelves. So magicians who do use technology are finding it harder to keep ahead of the curve. So generally what's working best is when magicians are using low tech and they're going back to stuff that people haven't seen for years, or they're creating new things. But theatre is what's working well.
Tim, we were talking about medical conferences before on air, and I noticed that you go to magicians' conferences.
We do.
And it got me thinking about what you do at a magicians' conference.
Well, I just came back from one in South Africa, the College of Magic in South Africa, and what we do is we do performances and we do lectures and we talk about the latest effects and we talk about how magic works and why we make it work, and everyone's got their own different approach. And so it's lots of sharing, and it's all behind the velvet curtain, you know. Yeah. It's all kept very secret.
Do you swap bunnies?
No. Oh, bunnies are very personal. Oh, people keep their own personal bunnies.
But you swap tricks, and so...
We do. We swap ideas and methods and stuff like that. It's very hard because sometimes there's a trick I do in my show, This Is Magic, it involves a can of Pepsi that's opened up and it's emptied and it crushes, and then it uncrushes itself and reseals itself and refills itself. And I was doing that around the world doing lectures and stuff like that, and I wouldn't teach it, but I'd perform it. And magicians were like, we need to know. And I'm like, no. And then other magicians started coming up with their own, like how they think it's done, and they're releasing it as like, this is the trick that Tim does. I'm like, no, that's not the trick. And so you end up, your hand is forced to actually have to release your effect. Otherwise people start buying copies of it and stuff like that. So in the end, David Blaine actually took that effect and contacted the original guy who came up with the idea and bought the TV rights, and then the whole market was open. And
can you,
know,
you own a trick? Can you own the rights to a trick?
Teller of Penn and Teller is the only one who's actually successfully litigated against somebody who copied his trick.
You can't claim copyright because it's not written down. You can't claim a patent because it's not an invention.
You have to register it as a theatre piece.
Even
as a theatre work.
Someone only has to make the slightest change to it and it's a new one.
Not necessarily. Once you register it as a theatre piece, if you've got the money to go to court,
what, every
then
time
you can
someone
defend
rips off your act. Nathan in Warrnambool can explain why your shop closed down.
Can he?
Everybody knows magic shops close when the profits disappear.
Oh.
That's pretty good. And apparently it moved anyway. It's now sort of it's an online.
All right, okay.
Bernard's Magic Shop moved to Victoria Street near Errol Street in North Melbourne, says Rich from East St Kilda. So there you go.
All right.
There we go. There we go. That's an excellent thing. So you can claim to own a trick. I guess it's more, is it more that your peers say, this is Tim's
trick?
It is.
There's a massive history of magic, and there's a lot of people who just specialise in the history of effects, and they'll sit down and research and go through, and somebody might say, oh, you know that classic trick where you've got three ropes that are unequal lengths and they join together, and they'll go through history and go through magazines and publications and try and find out who was the very first person to publish that.
And who
as
was?
An effect. That one is still in dispute. it was there was one guy who they said it's definitely this guy, and then somebody else came and said, but I've got some records of someone 3 years before him who was doing it, and so it's still being disputed. But there's such a rich history of magic of people who create these new effects.
Now, Tim, you offered to do some magic on the radio so everyone can see it.
I did. Well, if you want to see it, I'm going to do something really crazy, because normally, say, for example, you have a card chosen and then you reveal your prediction. I'm going to reveal my prediction in advance.
Right. So at the moment, let's just point out that Tim Ellis is sitting here. Sir Richard Taylor, Knight of the Realm, is our independent witness. Dr. Ranjana Srivastava is beyond reproach.
Absolutely.
Of impeccable character. And Tim is here with a unopened boxed pack of cards.
Red sealed. Bicycles. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Sealed. The seal's broken.
Yeah,
he's
broken.
Already tampered with them.
I've already tampered with them. Yeah. So I have a prediction. If people go to meldmagicfestival.com and they go down to the bottom of the page, there is a picture of Conversation Hour, a little illustration, Conversation Hour, and they click on that picture, they will see my prediction. The prediction of what's about to happen. So I can't change my prediction. You shouldn't look at it yet because you're going to find out. So, but anyone else who wants to go
I was just
there,
about to look on the internet.
I know. You can, but you can.
Okay, so you've already made
my prediction. It's
out
already
there. So what's the website?
MelbourneMagicFestival.com.
So, okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give you a moment or two. Go to MelbourneMagicFestival.com. Tim Ellis has already on the website predicted what's going to happen. So let's give people a moment or two.
All
it's
right.
11 minutes to 12, and let's see if your servers are melting. I hope you've got a very good internet service provider.
All right, and you can hear the cards.
First time my daughter, who was a lawyer, went through US immigration after she started practicing in Australia as a lawyer, she was asked what she did, and she said she was a solicitor, and they thought she meant she was a working girl. She had to explain she meant she was an attorney.
Oh, it's the same if I say I do tricks, you know, same problem.
This is Helen in Singapore. Oh, now, Bernard's moved to North Melbourne and that shop's closed down too, says JP in Sydney. It's disappeared. The magic shop's disappeared.
Well, I'll give a plug here. If people want to get some magic at the Melbourne Magic Festival, we have a shop in the foyer in our Magic Central here, so they can buy magic tricks.
Now, people have had a look at your prediction at MelbourneMagicFestival.com. Tim Ellis has opened up the cards. He's splayed the cards out like a croupier at a Melbourne casino.
Which will remain nameless.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you to choose a card and change one.
Get Richard to do it.
Okay, yeah. Richard.
Did you predict that?
Yeah, I didn't predict that at all.
No,
but I did predict
you are. Throwing a spanner in the works. Okay, so Richard, choose card.
Just touch anyone you want because I'm going to let you change your mind. Which one? This one here? Before we do anything else, do you want to stay with this card or do you want to change your mind?
I'll stay with it.
I'm going to give you a second chance to change your mind if you want to.
No.
You sure?
Yeah.
All right.
Richard takes the card.
Face down and don't look at it yet. If you'd gone one further, you would have got the Jack of Clubs. If you'd gone one earlier, you would have got the Two of Hearts. They're all different. You could have chosen. And I said you can change your mind.
Absolutely, you did. And I chose at random, and I was watching carefully that you weren't sort of making my making one jump out to my attention.
But you did choose from the middle of the pack.
I did that.
But he could have changed his mind. I did give him the offer.
Okay, so you've counted the cards, and you know what was between the Jack of clubs and the two of hearts?
I do. Yeah, it's okay. The card I wanted.
But it's the card you wanted because on the website you predicted that... don't turn it over yet. You predicted he would pick the...
Ten of diamonds.
Turn it over. The Ten of Diamonds. Sir Richard, there you are.
I'm so predictable. There we go.
Okay, so on the website, ladies and gentlemen, can you text me and tell me whether or not, in fact, he's just kidding us and he didn't pick... No, okay, Ross has had a look. He's my producer today. He's checking on the website. In fact,
that's
you
weird.
Picked the Ten of Diamonds.
But see, that time I did it because it was face down, so you didn't get a choice. But if you had a favourite card, John, and I don't know if you do. Do you have a favourite card?
A favourite card?
Yeah, like a card that you think, of course people say Ace of Spades or Ten of Hearts or something like that. But if I was to ask you to look at the cards and name, obviously not the Ten of Diamonds, but if I was to ask you to look at the card, name any of your favourite, what would you choose?
Anything. Oh, I don't have a favourite card.
Well, have a look at the selection
there.
Okay,
the there. Four of Spades. There
four
is.
Of Spades?
Yeah.
Where is that?
Just
oh, there it is.
The
okay, the Four of Spades.
Yeah.
So you could have chosen any card, but you chose the Four of Spades. Have a look.
Yeah. Okay, I've
I'll show you.
The Four of Spades.
There's nothing there. Look.
I've got the Four of Spades.
They're all. There's nothing fancy about the cards. You've seen them. Have a look at your card.
It's a Four of Spades.
Have a look on the outside.
Okay, now I have to explain this. I knew you would choose the Four of Spades. Is written on there. Okay, so there's something going on.
You can
here.
Keep that.
Okay, Ranjana, come on, you're the scientist.
I have a question for you,
yes.
A scientist question, actually.
Yes.
So, you know, I was looking at your CV,
you were.
It's wonderful and all this stuff you do. And then the doctor in me looked at the word diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that a few years ago, you were diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome.
That's correct.
And that really fascinated me because one of the, and you know, there are many, many features of the spectrum disorder and they've been in the news lately.
Yes.
But one of the things is that you can have a sort of an intense focus on something, but often there are issues that people have with social interactions.
Yes.
And yet here you are in one of the most social jobs of all.
Mm-hmm.
So my question really was, do you think that if you were diagnosed early on with Asperger's, perhaps that would have affected your growth and potential, and that just because you didn't know?
I don't think it would have changed anything.
Has it changed anything knowing now?
Not really, because this is the weird thing I find with Asperger's. It's just made me aware, because when I was younger, a lot of people thought that because I didn't do eye contact gazes and I was very shy, they thought that I was very arrogant, and they thought that I felt I was better than everybody else. And that was completely the opposite. But the Asperger's will, you know, you don't know how you
shy.
Come across to people.
Yeah.
And so people thought that I was like, I don't need to talk to you. I'm the superstar magician, all this sort of stuff. But it was just really, I was really nervous. I was really shy. I had no way of talking to people in social situations. But because Asperger's involves special interests, my special interest is magic. And I love the tricks, I love performing, I love creating tricks. But in order to perform, I have to create my own ways of coping and my own strategies to get up in front of people. I'm much more comfortable in front of 1,800, 2,000 people than I am in front of two or three. So
where do you get that insight from? Because many people with Asperger's would not have that insight.
Well, because I was not aware of having Asperger's. I was just aware that I was a bit eccentric or a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt, I'm a magician. I guess that's just the way I am. And so I would learn all my tricks and I'd perform the tricks and everything.
I knew you'd say that.
You're psychic.
I think
the difference for me is that with Asperger's, everything has to be black and white. I have to be like, this is that.
A bit and obsessive
magic,
too.
Yeah, magic is like that.
So magic, to learn magic, you have to be obsessive because you've got
absolutely.
To do it. How many times do you have to practice that trick?
That trick I invented, so it took
yeah, but
a long
how many,
time.
How many times do you have to do it before you can
hundreds
actually...
and hundreds of times. You just have to practice and practice and practice until
so
it becomes second nature.
You have to be compulsive.
Yeah, yeah. And I will wake up some mornings, I'll go, I've got an idea, and I'll start working on an idea, and I'll go, I should probably eat. Oh, it's midnight. And I've just gone through the entire day and time has just flown.
We know that exact thing.
I know,
yep,
I know.
We can appreciate that so entirely.
Yeah, and it's that obsessiveness. But also with Asperger's, because it's the whole special interest of magic, you find that you end up, you just behave differently. It's that old thing of taking everything literally. You know, people say to me, can you open that window? And I go, yes. Oh, do you want me to open the window? And they're like, you're a jerk. And I'm like, no, I was just taking it literally. and really
like
hasn't
people
changed.
Saying, can I ask you a question? You just did.
Yes. Yeah. But it really hasn't changed anything, because I think the thing with Asperger's is that once you've got it, you can learn a few coping mechanisms. But it's really like somebody going, oh, I know why you can't run. You don't have legs. And you go, oh, of course I don't have legs. All right. They go, come with me. You go, well, I still don't have legs. I still can't come.
It's just curious that it was diagnosed so late in your life.
I know. And it hasn't really made that much difference apart from me going, oh, now I can understand why I behave the way I behave. But even when I'm in a situation where I have to talk a particular way, or I have to ask, I'll still speak sort of Asperger-y, and I'll say things that I probably know I shouldn't say, but they just come out. Mm. And then as I'm saying them, I'm like, I shouldn't have said that. But it's just, yeah, I don't know if other people can control their Asperger's as much, but it's
tie that in with what you before were saying, Richard, about how we were calling it resilience of people because of the isolation of New Zealand or Australia compared to the rest of the world. But in fact, this is now a personal resilience on a microcosm.
It is. I had the great pleasure of interacting with two young women. They're 12, 13 years old last night at the museum. They're big fans of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And they, as their parents were saying, they both are challenged by dyslexia. But the great thing there is that dyslexia isn't so much a challenge, it's actually a blessing, because it arguably steers you away from an academic career, because it's most likely that you're not going to be able to journey down an academic future. But that means that due to your unique set of skills that dyslexia offers you, you can actually look forward to a very bright and creative future, as these two were already engaging with, writing, directing their own stuff, excited about a future, doing wonderful, fun things. And, you know, I think we're both living in countries that that allow people with differences to look forward to a brighter future than maybe they would in other parts of the world.
Yeah, Tim Ellis inviting you to go and have a look at melbournemagicfestival.com, and Sir Richard Taylor inviting you to head off to the Mill Museum for the Bug Lab. He's co-founder and creative director from the Weta Workshop in Wellington, and he's worked on all those films like The Hobbit and all those things and won Academy Awards and all the rest of it. Dr. Ranjana Srivastava, my co-host. It's been a fabulous, magical conversation, Aaron. It's been great fun. Thank you all very much for coming along. And, I've still got to work out how he did those tricks. This has been The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne.